Well, I want to welcome you to this particular edition of The Gathering Storm. My name is Dr. Andy Woods, and it's always a pleasure for me to sub in and contribute to this ministry. As I've said many times before, Dr. Mao Couch was a personal friend of mine, and he and I were really kindred spirits on many, many issues. In fact, all issues that I can think of, and I love to get together with him and do these various broadcasts. I'm saddened that he's not with us now. I'm happy for him because he's with the Lord in heaven, but it's certainly an honor for me to sub in periodically and help sort of continue the work that he began. What I'd like to accomplish in this hour that I have with you is what I would call a Magog update. And Dr. Couch, in the immediately prior CDs, as Dr. Lacey Couch put out for us, gave several teachings on the great Gog and Magog invasion that's described in Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39. I have no desire to relay the foundation that Dr. Couch has laid in those teachings. I think he spoke eloquently to the issue. The only thing I would like to do in this brief time that I have with you is sort of update some of the things that he had to say. Because, you see, he passed on not too long ago, and the political scenario keeps changing. It changes not in the sense that the scenario laid out by Dr. Couch becomes less credible, but it changes in the sense that the scenario that he laid out becomes more credible and more believable. And in fact, as we move closer and closer to the return of the Lord, and closer and closer to his return, and even as the Lord tarries, we can see the scenario of Ezekiel 38 and 39 not getting more obscure, but getting clearer and clearer and clearer. And I'd just like to bring some of the things to your attention that have gotten extremely clear in the last year or so, as we've looked at this Gog-Magog invasion and studied it in Ezekiel 38 and 39. I am not a date setter. Dr. Couch was not a date setter. But we both believe that just prior to the return of the Lord, there would be a prophetic scenario in place. Ezekiel 38 and 39 is part of that prophetic scenario. So here is sort of how I've organized my thoughts. I want to, number one, answer the who question. Who was involved in this invasion? Number two, I want to look at some strategic trends that I believe are setting the stage for the fulfillment of the Gog-Magog invasion. And then finally, as time permits, I want to give you some points of application. In other words, we have all of this information. Okay, so what? What do we do with it? So that's kind of the direction that we're moving in. Let's start with the who question. In Ezekiel 38 and verses 1 through 7, and I'm not going to reread the passage. Dr. Couch, in prior teachings, has read that passage and explained it very, very well. But what we have in Ezekiel 38, verses 1 through 7, are nine names. We have Magog, Rosh, Meshach, Tubal, Persia, Put, Cush, Gomer, and Togarma. You'll discover that these are all names found, with the exception of, I think, one, found in Genesis 10, verses 2 through 8, which is, in essence, a record of where Noah's descendants settled. And we can sort of discover the geographical areas where these groups settled. And the geographical areas of today, containing the areas where these groups settled, I believe, will constitute the nations that will come against Israel in the last days, as recorded in Ezekiel 38 and 39. And we can sort of document where these people groups settled by looking at scholarly sources such as Josephus and Herodotus, and also BDB, which is a Hebrew lexicon, which means Brown, Driver, and Briggs. So let's kind of go through these names. They seem sort of strange to us because Ezekiel spoke of them way back in the 6th century. But let's see if we can identify the geographical areas where these people groups settled, and that will help us identify the nations that will be involved in the great Gog and Magog invasion in the last days. The first name we run into is Magog, and Josephus in his Antiquities, book 1, chapter 6, section 1, calls Magog the Scythians. Now, any encyclopedia will tell you that the Scythians migrated from Central Asia to southern Russia in the 8th to the 7th century BC. And so I believe when Ezekiel uses these names, like this name Magog, he's speaking of a people group that he would be familiar with. And I believe, therefore, that this group Magog constitute the peoples of Central Asia. Modern names in the category of Central Asia would be Kazakhstan, Afghanistan, and the Ukraine. And the second name we run into is Rosh. Now, let me quote just for a minute from Gesenius. Gesenius was no slouch. He was the father of what we call modern-day lexicography. Lexicography is the science and art of compiling Hebrew lexicons and dictionaries. And Gesenius made a study of 10th century Byzantine writers, and he concluded that Rosh settled in what we call modern-day Russia. And one of the things that's very interesting about Gesenius is he reached his conclusions in 1846. 1846 was long before the Communist Revolution, and it was long before the rise of the Soviet Union as a nuclear superpower. So he simply was not reading modern-day the newspaper into the Bible. Many people accuse us as futurists of doing that. But Gesenius obviously was not doing that because Russia was a non-factor primarily on the world stage. She was not a threat at the time Gesenius reached his conclusions in 1846. We run into a couple of other names, Meshach and Tubal. Now, Herodotus, who wrote about 450, not too long after the time of Ezekiel. You remember Ezekiel is a 6th century prophet. He's one of our two exilic prophets. He prophesied for God during the days of the Babylonian captivity, while the nation of Israel and Judah in particular were in Babylon in captivity there, 350 miles to the east of Jerusalem. They were in captivity for 70 years. But Herodotus wrote a little bit after that time period, and he identifies Meshach and Tubal in his book called Histories. This would be chapter 3, sections 93 and 94. And also in chapter 7, section 78, he identifies Meshach and Tubal as a group of people living in the mountains southeast of the Black Sea, which would be modern-day Turkey. Taking a look just at Meshach for a minute, BDB identifies Meshach in Persian times. Now, Persian times is just right after the time of Ezekiel, in the general time period of Ezekiel. He identifies Meshach in Persian times as a group of people southeast of the Black Sea, which is modern-day Turkey. Josephus, in his Antiquities, Book 1, Chapter 6, Section 1, identifies Meshach as Cappadocia. Now, if you study 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 1, you'll find that phrase or that geographical area called Cappadocia, which most identify as modern-day Turkey, north central Turkey. And then taking a look at just this name Tubal for a minute, BDB also identifies Tubal as Cappadocia, which is modern-day Turkey. So I think we're on pretty safe footing to say that Meshach and Tubal represent modern-day Turkey. And then we have this fifth name, this nation called Persia. I believe Persia is the easiest nation to identify. You know, we read about Persia in the Bible. You know, it was Persia that conquered the Babylonians in Daniel chapter 5. It was Persia that allowed the Jews to return to the promised land under a Persian king named Cyrus. The whole book of Esther, for example, takes place while the Persians were in power. And Persia continued on as a modern-day nation. And Persia's name was changed to Iran in 1935. And then Iran switched from being the Islamic Republic of Iran, he switched into being the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1979. And that was under the days of Jimmy Carter, you might recall, with the long gas lines. The Shah, an ally of the United States, was in power, and he was toppled and deposed, and the Ayatollah Khomeini replaced him. And it's at that point in time that Iran became the Islamic Republic of Iran in our general time period in 1979. And I believe that that is what Ezekiel is describing when he mentions Persia. A sixth name we run into is Cush. Now, Josephus in book 1, chapter 6, section 2, identifies Cush as Ethiopia. In fact, the Hebrew word that's used there in the book of Ezekiel is Cush, but the New American Standard Bible just substitutes the word Ethiopia for Cush because the New American Standard Bible translators were so confident that Cush was Ethiopia that they just substitute the name Ethiopia for Cush. So I believe Cush is what we call modern-day Ethiopia. Now, there's an interesting note in the Ryrie Study Bible, and he says this, and he's making some comments there related to Ezekiel 38 and 39. Dr. Ryrie says, the ancient country of Ethiopia encompassed far more territory than the modern country of Ethiopia, since the ancient country includes the northern Sudan. The Wycliffe Bible Encyclopedia puts it this way, the designation Ethiopia is misleading, for it did not refer to the modern state of Ethiopia. Cush bordered Egypt on the south, or the modern-day Sudan. So who is Cush? Cush is Ethiopia, and we could actually call the Ethiopia that's mentioned in this prophecy the modern-day Sudan. And then we have a seventh nation that's mentioned here. This nation is called Put. BDB identifies Put as Libya. Josephus in his Antiquities in Book 1, Chapter 6, Section 2 also identifies Put as Libya. And so I believe Put is modern-day Libya. And then we run into Gomer. Josephus in his Antiquities, Book 1, Chapter 6, Section 2, identifies Gomer as Galatia. Now, you know about Galatia from the Bible. That's the area that Paul traveled to in his first missionary journey. In fact, Paul wrote a whole book to these folks called the Book of Galatians. And everybody identifies Galatia as modern-day Turkey. And then the last country we have mentioned here is Togarma. Josephus in his Antiquities, Book 1, Chapter 6, Section 1, identifies Togarma as Phrygia. Now, if you look at Acts 16 and verse 6, you'll see where Phrygia is. Phrygia is that territory in between Galatia and Asia that Paul traveled through on his second missionary journey, Acts 16, verse 6, and we would call that modern-day Turkey. So you see what we have done here is we have basically used scholarly sources to identify who these nine names are. A big help to us has been Josephus in his Antiquities. Josephus traces in his Antiquities where the folks in Genesis 10, the Table of Nations, settled, subsequent to the dispersion at the Tower of Babel, subsequent to the flood. And we can sort of identify the areas where these strange-sounding names settled, and I believe those are the territories that will invade Israel in the last days, according to Ezekiel's prophecy. So by way of review, Put would be Libya, Cush would be the modern-day Sudan, Persia would be Iran, Magog would be the countries of Central Asia, Rosh would be Russia, and then Meshach, Tubal, Gomer, and Togarma would be what we would call modern-day Turkey. So that sort of helps us, if you will, answer the who question. You know, who is going to be involved in this great invasion in the end times? Let me move into part two of this study, if I could. And I want to, if I can, identify some strategic trends that I believe are clearly setting the stage for this last day's invasion. You know, the book of Galatians chapter 4 and verse 4, you know, in essence says, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of law, born of woman. And so what it is revealing is God did not send his son into the world at any old time, but the world stage was properly set before Christ came into the world. There was something called Pax Romana, which means universal peace. There were universal Roman roads. Because of what Alexander the Great had done in the intertestamental period through something called Hellenization, the Greek language was the lingua franca of the day, the common language, which is a very rich, in-depth language, and so the right language was in place for the recording of the New Testament. Conditions were ripe because of this universal peace and Roman roads and things of that nature for rapid transmission of the gospel following the death, burial, resurrection, and ascension of our Lord Jesus Christ in the beginning of the church. So my point is God sent his son into the world at just the right time. The world stage was set properly before the first coming of Christ. Galatians 4 and verse 4 seems to talk about that. And if that is true for the first coming of Christ, would it not be also true for the second coming of Christ? Just as the world stage was properly set before the first coming of Jesus, certainly we could see that same type of thing happening today as the world stage is being set for the return of Jesus Christ. The stage or the table is being properly set, I believe, for the imminent Gog-Magog invasion. You know, before you go and can see a basketball game played out, the stage has to be set. You know, the teams have to come out and do warm-up drills. The bleachers have to fill up with fans. Someone has to start selling popcorn, typically. The referees come out. And when you see the stage coming together, you know that a game is about to be played. That basically is what is happening in our world right now as the world stage is being set for the fulfillment of the Gog-Magog invasion described in Ezekiel 38 and 39. And so what I want to draw your attention to are basically about three strategic trends that are properly setting the stage or the table for the fulfillment of this end time drama. Again, this is not to be a date setter, but it is simply to show that many of the things that Dr. Couch has talked about in these CDs are becoming clearer and clearer. You know, we're one day closer than we were yesterday. And certainly we see the crystal ball being polished in many respects. But let me just draw, if I could, three things to your attention. Number one, the first strategic trend I would draw your attention to is, number one, Israel's present regathering in unbelief. Israel's present regathering in unbelief. One of the things that is described, and you see this quite clearly in Ezekiel 38 and verse 8, that particular verse reads as follows: "After many days you will be summoned. In the latter years you will come into the land that is restored from the sword, whose inhabitants have been gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel, which had been a continual waste, but its people were brought out from the nations, and they are living securely, all of them." Now, as Dr. Couch has explained, this invasion that's going to happen related to Israel will result in her conversion to God. She will become a believing nation. And yet, how can a conglomerate of nations invade unbelieving Israel so the end product is she can become a believing nation unless you have an Israel living in unbelief nationally with national borders? And may I just say to you, that is exactly what we have. I would, and Dr. Couch, you know, held to this view as well, the idea that in the end time there are, for the nation of Israel, two great regatherings. There is a regathering in unbelief, setting the stage for this invasion, and then there will be a regathering in faith after this invasion is over, or as part of the aftermath of this invasion. In the first regathering, Israel returns to part of the land. In the second regathering, she returns to all of the land. In the first regathering, she returns in unbelief. In the second regathering, she returns in faith. In the first regathering, she is restored to the land only. In the second regathering, she is restored to the land and the Lord. The first and present regathering sets the stage for the tribulation period. It sets the stage for discipline, but in the second regathering, it will set the stage for the millennium. It will set the stage for blessing. And so I believe, and Dr. Couch believed this very strongly as well, that we are seeing currently happening before our eyes the first regathering in unbelief in preparation for the Gog-Magog invasion. In fact, this regathering began, it really kicked into high gear with Israel's Independence Day in May the 14th, 1948. And what you have to understand is something like this has never happened before in human history. When a nation is kicked out of their land, within a few generations, that nation ceases to exist. They simply assimilate into their host culture. They lose their own culture. They lose their own language. And look at what has happened with Israel. Israel, since AD 70, has been out of her land, dispersed into all the nations of the world for 2,000 years. And yet her culture is preserved, her religion is preserved, her language is preserved, and 2,000 years pass. She never assimilates into the host cultures of the earth, but she is regathered back into her own land. Now, something like this has never happened before in history, and it has to be the hand of God. You know, people say, well, why doesn't God perform miracles today? My goodness, look at the Middle East and you will see a modern day miracle. Let me ask you a question. How many Amalekites do you know? How many Jebusites do you know? How many Girgashites do you know? The fact of the matter is we know of no such people, but they're mentioned in the Old Testament right alongside Israel. Well, why don't we hear about Amalekites? Because they assimilated into their host cultures. They disappeared as a people group, but not so the nation of Israel, because God has a great promise and program in store for them. They are the only nation in the history of the world that has an actual formal covenant with God going back to Genesis chapter 15 and what we call the Abrahamic covenant. And one of the things people like to say is they say, well, how can God's hand be at work today in the nation of Israel? Don't you understand that those people are a bunch of unbelievers? Well, as my friend Dr. Thomas Ice likes to say, guess what you have to be before you can be a believer? You have to be an unbeliever. Is it not true that God was at work in your life before you got saved? Of course He was. We can clearly look back and see the hand of God in all of our lives prior to salvation. And that is what is happening with the nation of Israel. So the first strategic trend that we see happening, setting the stage for the Gog-Magog invasion, is a present gathering of Israel in unbelief. Let me give you a second trend, if I can, and that has to do with a present gathering of a coalition of nations with a hostile intent towards the nation of Israel. There must be a present gathering of a coalition of nations with a hostile intent towards the nation of Israel. Why are these nations, these nine nations that I mentioned a little earlier, why are they going to invade the nation of Israel? The prophet Ezekiel tells us, if you take a look at Ezekiel chapter 38, and you take a look at verse 12, it says, to capture spoil and to seize plunder, and to turn your hand against the waste places. They are invading Israel in the last days, primarily because of jealousy related to Israel's wealth. It is interesting that ever since Israel has become a nation again in 1948, her wealth has increased. In fact, Israel's gross domestic product has outstripped that of her neighbors. Here's some statistics from the CIA World Factbook published in 2005. Israel's gross domestic product is $123 billion. Egypt's is only $81 billion. Syria's is only $26 billion. Lebanon's is only $21 billion. Jordan, which is just across, just to the east of the nation of Israel, the other side of the Dead Sea, is only $12 billion. And so these nations, I believe, are jealous of Israel's prosperity, and that's why they will invade Israel in the last days. Here is a quote, if I can read it to you. It's called The Rothschilds' Palestine, All Roads Lead to Jerusalem. And here's what the quote says. The value of minerals of the Dead Sea is estimated at $5 trillion. This estimate appears to be optimistic, but it is supported by the report of the Crown agents of the British colonies entitled Production of Minerals from the Waters of the Dead Sea. This official report estimates the minerals, except oil, in 1925 as follows. Magnesium chloride, 22,000 tons, valuing $600 billion. Potassium chloride, 20,000 tons, valued at $75 billion. Other minerals valued at $1,200 billion, or a total of about $3 trillion, exclusive of oil. Israel, because of these mineral deposits in the Dead Sea, is sitting on top of incredible wealth, and consequently these nations will invade, Ezekiel tells us, to get their hands on the wealth. It is interesting that in the summer of 2010, oil deposits of natural gas were found along Israel's northern coastline. I've had many people tell me that through fracking, which is something that takes place in the oil industry, because of fracking, Israel's wealth is about to exponentially increase. In fact, there's actually an oil company called Oil in Zion, and it's all about discovering oil in the nation of Israel. So why are these nations going to invade in the last days? I mean, very simply put, their goal is to get their hands on all of this great money and resources that have accumulated in the land of Israel. Very interesting prophecy is found in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 33 and verse 24, and it says this, of Asher, He said, more blessed than sons is Asher. May he be favored by his brothers, and may he dip his foot in oil. And this is a prophecy of Moses just before he died there on the plains of Moab. He could not enter the promised land, you recall from the Bible. But he made many prophecies about the various tribes just prior to his death. Things that would happen in the future of these tribes and of Asher, Deuteronomy 33:24, it says, may he dip his foot in oil. There's a debate on exactly what oil means there, but we can all agree on this much, that it's a prophecy of incredible wealth accumulating to the nation of Israel in the last days. What do we see happening before us? We see a present gathering of a coalition of nations with a hostile intent towards the nation of Israel. Let's look at those nations, if we could, just a little more carefully. You take a look at these nations that we've mentioned earlier, and let me ask you a question. What do all of them have in common? All of them with the exception of Rosh or Russia. Well, the thing that they all have in common is all of them are Islamic. And may I just say to you that Islam is the common denominator that provides, I believe, the stimulus or the motivation for the invasion of Israel in the last days. Yes, wealth will be part of it, and covetousness will be part of it, but Islamic ideology or religion is part of it as well. Now, I know that there are many Muslims that God desires to reach with the gospel. God loves Muslims, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. So I am not here criticizing Muslims. What I am criticizing, as I'll show you, is Islamic theology or ideology. Because you see, to the Muslim, to the faith of Islam, Jerusalem is a holy site. In their minds, that is the place where Muhammad ascended to Allah. And what you have to understand with Muslims is once they have ruled over a certain area, as Muslims once did over the city of Jerusalem in Israel, once they have ruled over a certain area, that area belongs irrevocably to Allah. And any nation that is existing where they once ruled is viewed as a sign or a token of disrespect to Allah. And this is why the nation of Israel doesn't even appear on most Islamic maps. To the Islamic mind, that territory does not belong to the Jews. It belongs irrevocably to Allah. And what you have to understand about Islamic theology and Islamic ideology is the nation of Israel is an interloper. The nation of Israel is in the way. And in essence, the Islamic conglomeration of nations will never be satisfied until Israel is driven into the sea. There's a very interesting quote here from Benjamin Netanyahu, and he says something to the effect of, if the Arabs put down their weapons today, there would be no more war. However, on the other hand, if Israel put down its weapons today, there would be no more Israel. And Israel is a very small nation. It's about the size of New Jersey, in a sea of totalitarian dictatorships. I believe she is surrounded by about 22 totalitarian dictatorships. And she is the only functioning democracy in the Middle East with any real semblance of human rights, freedom of press, freedom of religion, elections, fair and free elections, things of that nature. And that's tiny Israel in this sea of hostile Islamic dictatorships and theocracies. And these theocracies have said over and over again that they want to drive the nation of Israel into the sea. That is their ultimate goal. To prove this, it's not that hard to do. The Palestine Liberation Organization says over and over again, we just want to roll back Israel to her pre-1967 borders. If we could just roll her back to her pre-1967 borders, we'd be happy. Well, that's very interesting because the Palestinian Liberation Organization was founded in 1964, 3 years before Israel got those extended territories in Judea and Samaria and the West Bank, so-called, and others. So this idea of land for peace is really a ruse. Really, the whole idea is to reduce Israel's borders so it will make it easier for this conglomeration of nations to wipe Israel out. It's interesting that the nations that I spoke of a little earlier are nations that are very prominent in what's called the Arab Spring of 2010. And what the Arab Spring was all about is one moderate Muslim regime was toppled one after another and replaced by something worse. A more radical form of Islam replaced these various nations that were toppled in the Arab Spring in 2010. And so the stage very clearly to me is being set for this Gog-Magog invasion. In fact, those nations that I mentioned a little bit earlier form what our former president George W. Bush called the Great Axis of Evil. And one of the things that you see spoken of by this Islamic coalition is something called caliphate. Caliphate refers to the worldwide submission to Sharia law. Let me quote to you the Quran. I'm in Surah 24, colon 55. And here's what the Quran says. Allah has promised those among you who believe and do good deeds that He will certainly give them the caliphate in the earth the way He gave to those before them, and that He will certainly establish for them their religion which He has chosen for them, and will turn their prior fear into peace. And then it goes on, it says they must worship Me and so forth. So this idea of caliphate, worldwide submission to Sharia law, is something deeply ingrained in Islamic doctrine and theology and in the Islamic psyche. And I believe that this is the unifying religious force that will stimulate this last day's invasion spoken of in Ezekiel 38 and 39. Let me take a little closer look, if I could, at some of the specific nations that we mentioned. Earlier, we identified about 9 nations that will be involved in this last day's invasion. We mentioned a nation called Persia, which we said was Iran. And you have to understand that when Ezekiel had this prophecy in the 6th century B.C., Persia was not an enemy of Israel, but was in fact a friend of Israel. In fact, it was the Persians that allowed the Jews to return into their homeland following the 70-year captivity. And so this prophecy probably seemed crazy to Ezekiel that Persia would turn against the Jews one day. And it's even seemed crazy to us in our lifetimes. Because you see, prior to 1979, Iran was an ally of Israel and the United States of America. But once the Shah was toppled and replaced by the Ayatollah, and Iran became Islamicized, suddenly Ezekiel's prophecy started to make a lot of sense. Now, the leader of Iran, the former leader, was a man named Ahmadinejad. He is, or was, a Holocaust denier. He is the one that went to the United Nations and said Israel must be wiped off the map. He is what is called a Twelver, and basically what that means is the 12th Imam, or return to earth during a time of warfare, which he can hasten through the destruction of the great Satan, the United States of America, and the little Satan, Israel. So his goal was to create havoc in the world, to hasten the return of this 12th Imam, This is part of his religion as a Shiite Muslim. And this is a diabolical regime that is on the precipice of getting its hands on nuclear weapons. Now, Ahmadinejad was replaced by Rouhani in August of 2013. The world community has tried to, and the world media has tried to promote Rouhani as a moderate. To me, that's more dangerous because at least Ahmadinejad was overt in what he was saying, but this man, Rouhani, is more clandestine, and consequently it's harder to see what his true sinister agenda is. But you have to understand that the nuclear program has accelerated under Rouhani. It has not slowed down. And Persia, or Iran, is hastening its way to the nuclear finish line. Another nation that is mentioned by Ezekiel is Cush, and you remember we identified Cush as the Sudan. The Sudan is the place where one of the great genocides of the world is taking place as we speak, called the Darfur genocide. Beyond that, it was the Sudan that harbored Osama bin Laden between 1991 to 1996. Another nation that Ezekiel mentions is Put. You remember we identified Put as Libya. Libya was the home of Muammar Gaddafi, a very diabolical ruler. I remember in the 1980s he blew up some discotheques and threatened the lives of Americans. And Ronald Reagan, wisely in my estimation, sent some weaponry and took out Gaddafi. I don't think he hit Gaddafi, but I think he took out some of his family and property and so forth. And we didn't hear from Gaddafi for several decades because of what Reagan did. But you see, Gaddafi was toppled and replaced in Libya by the Muslim Brotherhood. And so what you see is Put, or Libya, becoming more and more radicalized. And consequently, that is another nation that is falling into proper orbit for the fulfillment of Ezekiel's prophecies. Now, Libya, you might remember, is where Benghazi, the whole Benghazi situation occurred. That's where four Americans lost their lives, including Ambassador Stevens. And something like this has not happened since 1979, when you recall the embassy in Iran, the American embassy in Iran was taken. And the President of the United States, Barack Hussein Obama, in order to deflect attention from this event so that he could win the 2012 election, blamed all of these things on a spontaneous uprising because of some B-rated video that was supposedly made. And he and his team got in front of the American people and basically lied about what happened so that he could win the election. And if you believe that this event here in Benghazi happened because of a spontaneous video and an uprising, I've got some beachfront property in Arizona to sell you, because that attack in Benghazi happened on September the 11th. September the 11th is the same day our Twin Towers were taken down in 2001, you'll recall. And there was very sophisticated armament and weaponry involved in what happened in Benghazi. And so this is all signs of a very radical regime in Libya, and that nation is falling into proper orbit to fulfill Ezekiel's prophecy in Ezekiel 38 and 39. Now, you'll also remember that Meshach, Tubal, Gomer, and Togarma were mentioned in Ezekiel's prophecy, and we said that those nations represented modern-day Turkey. Now, what's interesting is Turkey was a longtime ally of the United States of America, actually was a member of NATO, was actually an ally of Israel, but like Iran, Turkey has moved away from being a secular government to an Islamic republic. Turkey was recently rebuffed for entrance into the European Union. And so because they've been rejected by the European Union and because they're becoming more and more radicalized, it stands to reason that this nation would become an ally of would become an ally in this conglomeration that will invade Israel in the last days. In fact, it's very interesting that a Turkish ship seeking to break Israel's blockade of Gaza was stopped, you'll recall, by the nation of Israel. This made the news. This was a big event on May the 31st of 2010, and it's important to understand that that ship came from Turkey. And so Turkey, just like Libya, just like the Sudan, just like Iran, is falling into proper place, I believe, for the fulfillment of Ezekiel's prophecy. And then we run into this country called Rosh. And Rosh, we said, was Russia. Now, what's very interesting is the state adopted Christianity from the Byzantine Empire in 988. In other words, at one time, Rosh or Russia was what we would call an Orthodox Christian country. And yet, what we have seen in modern times is how Russia has risen and is becoming a country that has a ferocious appetite towards the nation of Israel and surrounding nations. We remember very well the expansionistic policies of the Cold War era for Russia or the former Soviet Union. It is interesting that Russia has always aligned herself with the Arabic nations when the Arabic nations have invaded the nation of Israel in recent times. We remember Rosh or Russia rolling right over Georgia, neighboring Georgia, in 2008. And most recently, we see very clearly what Rosh or Russia has done in its aggressive attitudes and actions in the Ukraine in 2014. Could it be that even Rosh or Russia will one day become Islamicized like these other countries we've mentioned? Here's a statistic from Ronald Schauer's book, The Coming Apocalypse. Dr. Ronald Schauer was a good friend of Dr. Couch. He wrote a wonderful book called The Coming Apocalypse. And in this particular book, Dr. Schauer says that the average Islamic couple has five children. In 1991, there were 300 mosques in Russia. By the year 2015, it's anticipated that there will be 25,000 mosques in Russia. So even Russia is fitting into the scenario that Ezekiel said would happen in the last days. One of the things that Ezekiel sees in this prophecy, Ezekiel 38 verses 1 through 7, is an alliance with Iran. An alliance between Russia and Iran. Now, it's interesting that Iran needed its military rebuilt from the Iran-Iraq war. Russia, on the other hand, needed money because of the collapse of its economy due to the failure of communism and a centralized economy. So you have this scenario where Russia has weapons but no cash. Iran, on the other hand, has cash but no weapons. And so the two of them got together. Russia began to give Iran weapons, and Iran began to give Russia cash. It's a match made in heaven, or better said, a match made in hell. But what you see is a prophecy that Ezekiel saw 2,600 years ago about an alliance forming between Russia and Iran. And such an alliance seemed inconceivable, no doubt, to Ezekiel. It even seemed inconceivable to us. Because, you see, prior to 1979, Iran was an ally of the United States of America. But with the toppling of the Shah and the advent of the Ayatollah, Iran became hostile. And so you have this scenario where Iran is now hostile, Russia is now hostile. The two of them have formed an alliance together. And this is the exact thing that Ezekiel saw 2,600 years ago when he was prophesying during the Babylonian captivity. One of the questions you might be asking is, well, what about America? What about the late, great United States of America? It is interesting that America is not mentioned in this prophecy. America is not mentioned, really, that I know of, in Bible prophecy at all. You say, well, that seems very strange. Certainly America would come to the aid of Israel, wouldn't she? One of the things that most people do not understand is how Richard Nixon, in 1973, you know, you can think whatever you want about Richard Nixon, but the fact of the matter is Richard Nixon saved the nation of Israel from extinction. Let me read to you a couple of excerpts from a blog article. This comes from ChristianBlog.com, and the title of it is God Uses Presidents for His Own Purposes, and the author is Dorothy Vaughn Leahy. And this particular writer says this: as a young boy growing up, Richard Nixon's Christian and Quaker mother told him that one day he would be in a powerful position and a situation would arise where Israel and the Jews needed his help. When it did, he was to help them. It was reported that Nixon said he heard the voice of his mother saying these words to him when he responded to the call and plea for help from Golda Meir at 3 a.m. in October of 1973 during what is called the Yom Kippur War. Then came the attacks on October 6, 1973, a coordinate surprise attack on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the Jewish calendar, and a time when the entire nation comes to a virtual standstill. Even non-observant Jews honored this holiday by fasting, staying home, or going to the synagogue and refraining from the use of fire, electricity, communication systems. Israel could not have been more vulnerable. There had been concern about possible attacks, but until just shortly before the attacks began, Israeli intelligence was not able to determine conclusively that an attack was imminent. To demonstrate how much Israel was up against, 180 Israeli tanks faced over 1,400 Syrian tanks. Closer to the Suez Canal, a mere 436 Israeli infantry were posed to fight over 80,000 Egyptian soldiers. The attacks by Egypt and Syria were backed by 9 Arab states as well as the Soviet Union. By the second day, the slaughter of the Israeli troops and the destruction of their equipment had been such a blow. Moshe Dayan, the Minister of Defense, who had been a hero in the Six-Day War, started to talk about pulling back and even possible surrender. Golda Meir, Minister of Israel, resisted this, but she did have an aide secure lethal pills from her doctor, just in case the Arab enemies prevailed. Meir would take her own life. U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and Meir's relationship was rocky, to say the least. When assistance was requested from him, Kissinger's reported response was to let Israel bleed a little. So at 3 a.m., Golda Meir picked up the phone and called President Richard M. Nixon and asked for help. It is reported that Nixon heard the prophetic word and the voice of his mother as he listened to Meir. By the time she hung up, Golda Meir had the weapons to help her country, and that swung the pendulum to Israel's favor and brought to an end the Yom Kippur War. To this day, Richard Nixon is highly regarded in Israel. Prime Minister Golda Meir and Nixon kept in frequent touch throughout the ordeal. For the rest of Meir's life, she referred to Nixon as my president and said, for generations to come, all will be told of the miracle of the immense planes from the United States bringing in the material that meant life to our people. You see, the United States of America has always been a faithful ally to Israel. The United States of America has always stood up for Israel. You can think whatever you want about Richard Nixon. Certainly the man had his flaws. But had Nixon not been in the White House, 1973, I believe, would have been completely different. I believe God providentially put Nixon in that position to help Israel. But what has happened to the United States of America? Beginning with our 41st president, George Herbert Walker Bush, the relationship that America has had with Israel has become increasingly frostier and colder. And almost every president we've had since that time, the relationship between America and Israel has gotten worse and worse and worse, right up to the present president of the United States, Barack Hussein Obama, who has publicly stated he wants to put daylight between the United States of America and Israel. He has no time to meet with the Israeli delegation because he's too busy with fundraisers for his next political campaign. He is the president that is arming Egypt as we speak. He is the president who has beneath him a Secretary of State, John Kerry, who has called the nation of Israel an apartheid state. And, you know, we have to ask ourselves, does America need Israel? I think she does. Does Israel need America? Not necessarily. You see, I take Genesis chapter 12, verse 3 very seriously, where it says, God blesses those who will bless the nation of Israel. I want to see our nation bless the nation of Israel so we can be blessed. I don't necessarily believe Israel needs America, but I do believe America does need Israel. And so we see very clearly a coalition of nations coming together, exactly like Ezekiel predicted. No American intervention or alliance whatsoever. And I believe that the stage is being set for the fulfillment of the Gog-Magog invasion. Very quickly, a third strategic trend, if I can draw your attention to it, is you have to have a scenario in place whereby an overwhelming coalition of nations comes against Israel and yet is miraculously rebuffed. May I just say to you that this has already happened on a smaller scale. Israel has always been outnumbered and outgunned, and yet she miraculously survives. This happened in 1948 with the War of Independence. It happened in 1967 with the Six-Day War. It happened again in 1973 in the Yom Kippur War. That's where God strategically used Richard Nixon, as I explained just a little earlier. It happened again in 1990 in the Persian Gulf War. And may I just say to you that this invasion of a hostile coalition of nations where Israel miraculously survives has already happened many, many times in the form of a dress rehearsal. Many dress rehearsals have already taken place. And it's almost as if God is saying, you've seen the dress rehearsals, now get ready for the big show. Get ready for the ultimate invasion. And that's what is going to happen in Ezekiel 38 and 39. A great coalition of nations will invade Israel, and yet Israel will miraculously survive. And so my point is, history has finally caught up to Ezekiel's prophecies that he saw 2,600 years ago in Babylonian captivity. You know, if I was talking this way 100 years ago, people would think I was insane. But now as I talk this way, I have the attention of many, many people because the scenario that Ezekiel predicted is credible. It's very credible what is happening. So there are clearly three strategic trends at work, which I believe are setting the stage for this last day's invasion. Number one, Israel's present regathering in unbelief. Number two, a present regathering of a coalition of nations with a hostile intent towards Israel. And number three, the scenarios in place whereby an overwhelming coalition of nations will come against Israel, and yet Israel will miraculously survive. Just by way of conclusion, I've got just a couple seconds left. Let me give you, if I could, some points of application. Number one, prophecy is proof of biblical inspiration. Only an omniscient God has the ability to reveal the end from the beginning. We have great confidence that God's word is true because prophecies like this are so credible. How could Ezekiel have known these things unless God revealed it to him? Number two, prophecy has a calming effect on the believer. You know, the world seems like it's wildly out of control from our perspective. And yet when we see the world fitting into a scenario prophesied by Ezekiel 2,600 years ago, we begin to understand that God very much is in control of history, and we need to simply trust Him and His plan. Number three, we need not fear the rise of radical Islam. Because you see, as Dr. Couch has explained, God is going to rebuff these nations and deal with them very aggressively. So yes, Islam is on the rise, but God has a program in mind where Islam will one day fall. And so we need not be intimidated by Islam. God has Islam very much under control. Number four, this prophecy is a reminder of God's faithfulness to us. Look at how God is going to protect His tiny nation in the last days that has been in rebellion against Him all of these thousands of years. If God is not going to forget Israel, guess what? He's not going to forget you either. And He's not going to forget me. God is a covenant-making, covenant-keeping God. Number five, keep your eye on Israel. Ezekiel chapter 38 and verse 12 describes the nation of Israel as dwelling at the center of the earth. Let me read that verse to you if I could. Ezekiel 38 and verse 12. To capture spoil, to seize plunder, the verse goes on. To those who have acquired cattle and goods, who live at the center of the world. You'll find the same thing in Ezekiel chapter 5 and verse 5. You see, Israel seems like a nation that's just in the way of progress to the unsaved person. And yet, as far as God is concerned, the nation of Israel is the centerpiece of His divine program. And so we as Christians must always keep our eye on the nation of Israel. Blackstone, in a book called Jesus is Coming. This is a book that's precious to me. It's one of the books that Dr. Couch bequeathed to me in his massive library that I was privileged to inherit. It says this, and Blackstone wrote this in 1908, "If anyone desires to know our place in God's chronology, our position in the great march of events, look at Israel." Number six, we can support Israel. If Satan's plan is to wipe out Israel and God's plan is to protect Israel, we should get on God's side. We should pray, as Psalm 122 verse 6 says, pray for the peace of Jerusalem. We should speak up for Israel. We should be Israel's best friends. We should vote intelligently. It is very interesting to me that 85% of Israel's American Jewish voters voted for Romney in the prior presidential election. We know that Barack Obama won that election, but if you just look at who Jewish Americans voted for, that would be individuals who are Americans living in the land of Israel. They voted for Romney. So they believe that Obama did not have Israel's best interests at heart, but Romney did. That to me is a very interesting statistic. Those who are depending on the policies of a president for their survival because they're living in the land of Israel voted for the Republican ticket. I don't know if the Republican Party is the savior to all of our problems, but that to me is a very interesting statistic, and I hardly see it reported on at all. And then finally, number seven, we need to remember that we're living on borrowed time. As we see the events taking place in the Middle East, preparing us for the coming Gog and Magog invasion, we believe that the rapture of the church cannot be far away. simply because the rapture takes place before the 70th week of Daniel even begins. So these are some just basic points of application that we can take away from this study. Number one, prophecy is proof of biblical inspiration. Number two, prophecy has a calming effect on the believer. Number three, we need not fear the rise of radical Islam. Number four, prophecy is a reminder of God's faithfulness. Number five, keep your eye on Israel. Number six, support Israel. And number seven, remember that we're living on borrowed time and we need to use what few opportunities that we have left in front of us for the Lord's glory. We don't know how many opportunities will continue to exist as we get closer and closer to the end times. So just wanted to share with you a Gog Magog update. We've answered the who question, looked at the various nations that are involved. Number two, we looked at some strategic trends that are setting the stage for this last day's invasion. And number three, we looked at about 7 points of application. It's a pleasure for me to be with you on this brief time that we had. And I hope these things will change your life and impact you for eternity. God bless.